I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. A verdict in the trial board hearing of Lieutenant Brian Rice, the highest-ranking officer involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray. Like Caesar Goodson before him, Rice has been cleared of all charges. The verdict comes as the city grieves its 309th homicide of the year. Baltimore Police Detective Sean Suter, who died yesterday after being shot in Harlem Park on Wednesday. The killer remains at large. The House passes a tax bill. Attorney General Jeff Sessions tries to clarify previous testimony regarding contact with the Russians during the presidential campaign. And the campaign of Roy Moore continues despite calls from Senate leaders for him to leave the race. Kerry Johnson, NPR's justice correspondent, Andy Green of the Baltimore Sun, political columnist Barry Raskovar, and WIPR's Dominique Maria Banesi join me right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. It is the Midday News Wrap. We're going to look into several national and local stories in the news this week. Here in Baltimore, Police Detective Sean Suter, a 43-year-old father of five children, died yesterday from injuries he received when he was shot on Wednesday afternoon in Harlem Park while investigating another murder that had taken place in that violence-ridden neighborhood. There has been a verdict in the trial board hearing for Lieutenant Brian Rice, the highest-ranking officer involved in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray in 2015. Officer Rice has been cleared of all charges. A little later in the show, we'll speak with WIPR's Dominique Maria Bonesi, who was at the University of Baltimore this morning when the verdict was announced. We'll also speak to Baltimore Sun opinion editor Andy Green and longtime columnist Barry Raskovar about these and other local and national stories, including Senator Al Franken's apology for sexually harassing a reporter 12 years ago, the tax code revision passed by the House yesterday, and the status of the Senate plan now that it's tied to repealing the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act. But first, for some context on Jeff Sessions' testimony this week to the House Judiciary Committee, the ongoing Russia investigation, and the special election in Alabama, NPR justice correspondent Kerry Johnson joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Hey, Kerry, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
So let's start first with this special election in Alabama that is sort of hovering over everything else happening in the Senate. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, has floated the idea of Jeff Sessions being a write-in candidate. You talked to some people in the Sessions camp. What do you think the chances of that happening are?
People close to Sessions are telling me that they've been on the ground in Alabama trying to tamp down this idea. Jeff Sessions, for 20 years in the U.S. Senate, enjoyed his time there. But as he testified this week and says to anybody who will listen, being the Attorney General of the United States is the best job he'll ever have. He reveres the Justice Department, he says, and he doesn't intend to go anywhere. So despite his old friend Mitch McConnell from the Senate trying to press him back into service, Jeff Sessions is not receptive to this idea, and I think it would take a lot in order to get him to leave the Justice Department now.
And he's not receptive even in the face of his boss, the President of the United States, having very often some pretty harsh things to say about Jeff Sessions.
Yeah, the president has told anyone who will listen, including the New York Times and everybody who follows his Twitter feed, that he's not happy with the Justice Department or the FBI. He's very unhappy with Jeff Sessions for recusing himself from this Russia investigation back in back earlier this year, which indirectly led to the appointment of a special counsel, former FBI Director Robert Mueller. President Trump also is unhappy with the Justice Department for not launching an investigation of his political opponent, Hillary Clinton. But Jeff Sessions and others at DOJ have said they need a factual basis, a predicate, in order to launch an investigation. And they also warn that the president trying to politicize law enforcement is a dangerous, dangerous place to be.
So in his testimony on Tuesday to the House Judiciary Committee, Mr. Sessions did say, because he was asked about Roy Moore, the current Republican candidate for the Senate in Alabama, who, of course, has been accused by multiple women of sexual harassment, and several of those instances involve pedophilia. The children that he was harassing and assaulting were underage. Mr. Sessions said that he had no reason to doubt the accusers of former Judge Roy Moore. Given that admission, what does that do to his decision to not want to get back into the fray, or did he give any indication that he thought somebody else should be a write-in candidate?
Jeff Sessions said that he wanted to stay out of the issue of the election, in part because some of his friends were involved in the campaign. Remember Luther Strange, the man who is filling his seat now on a temporary basis, is a friend of Jeff Sessions. And they had been longtime pals back in Alabama. Sessions says he wants to be careful for ethics reasons not to opine on that race. He did testify this week. He has no reason to doubt these young women accusing Roy Moore of assorted crimes and allegations or alleged crimes. But the attorney general said he wasn't going to weigh in on that either. He said, generally speaking, if there are investigations of that, that would be the province of state authorities, not the U.S. Justice Department. But he was very careful in his language there, both with respect to any investigations and the outcome of this Senate contest.
And when it comes to retaliation against political opponents, he was asked at the hearing directly about that by several Democrats, Representative John Conyers. But then Republicans were very much urging him, in fact, to open an investigation and appoint a special prosecutor to look into Hillary Clinton and this Uranium One deal that took place while she was Secretary of State. Did he put the kibosh on that completely? I mean, did he fully disappoint the Republicans who were looking for another special prosecutor?
Tom, no commitment one way or the other. It's remarkable, though, that the night before this House Judiciary hearing this week, the Justice Department sent a letter to Republicans on Capitol Hill saying that Jeff Sessions and his deputy had directed senior federal prosecutors to take a look at some of these allegations involving Hillary Clinton, the uranium deal, the Clinton Foundation, and a host of other issues related to Hillary Clinton's email, to see whether there was anything there and to recommend whether or not a special counsel should be appointed. That letter didn't tilt one way or another in terms of the outcome. And when Jeff Sessions was pressed about it by both Democrats and Republicans in his testimony the following day, Sessions said, looks bad is not, or looks like something bad is not enough basis to launch a criminal investigation, let alone appoint a special counsel. He said that federal prosecutors would be evaluating that question, but he gave no time frame and did not suggest one way or another where he wanted that to land. And according to Democrats, Jeff Sessions shouldn't have a role in that decision to begin with, because remember, Tom, he's recused from anything having to do with Hillary Clinton because he was such a top and public surrogate for President Trump during last year's campaign.
So the special counsel that is in place, Robert Mueller, who was appointed by Rod Rosenstein, the assistant attorney general, surprised some folks on the Trump campaign when it surfaced that last month he issued subpoenas to several people involved in the campaign. This surprised a whole bunch of people because, putatively, the campaign has been cooperating with the special counsel's office. What do you make of the fact that Mr. Mueller saw fit to issue subpoenas as he conducts his investigation?
It doesn't seem to me to be a remarkable step. You know, it makes sense. He's operating, Robert Mueller, using at least two grand juries that we know about in Washington, D.C. and the Eastern District of Virginia and Alexandria, suburban D.C. And he just wants to be clear, and his prosecutors and agents want to be clear, that they're getting everything to which they're entitled. We know that there have been concerns in the past about destruction, possible destruction of evidence. Remember, the FBI conducted that very unusual no-knock search of Paul Manafort's home in Virginia in the summer. That is not normally a step that's taken in white-collar cases, but we now know that Mueller's team and his investigators were concerned about the destruction of evidence and, in fact, and the criminal charges against Paul Manafort, who was for a time Donald Trump's campaign chairman last year. Authorities have disclosed that they found materials in their search of his residence that he had not previously turned over and that were useful in forming the basis of the conspiracy charges against Manafort. Important to note, Manafort is contesting those charges, has pleaded not guilty.
Last week, you did a story about former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and his son. They are also definitely people about whom Mr. Mueller wants to know more, particularly in regard to their activities with Turkey. Tell us what's going on with that. What does Mr. Flynn have in his future, as far as we can tell?
So Mike Flynn, of course, was already under the investigative radar. Former acting Attorney General Sally Yates, an Obama administration holdover, had warned the White House earlier this year, she's testified, that Mike Flynn may have not been truthful in an interview with FBI investigators earlier this year about his contacts with the Russian ambassador and other matters. We know also that Mike Flynn belatedly had to file a Foreign Agents Registration Act filing with the Justice Department this year after he left the White House's national security advisor, disclosing some payments he got from people close to the government of Turkey. And we also know that Robert Mueller's investigators are interested in Flynn on all three of those points. One, whether he was truthful in his FBI interviews this year. Two, whether he should have filed as a foreign agent and didn't do so for particular reasons. And three, this bombshell report from the Wall Street Journal last week that Mueller's investigators are examining whether Flynn was promised something like $15 million in order to try to engineer a way to get the Turkish leader's enemy, who an elderly cleric who lives in Pennsylvania, back to Turkey into the hands of President Erdogan. Flynn's lawyers have denied those allegations, called them prejudicial and outrageous. But we do know that investigators are asking those questions, and the Mueller team is hot and heavy on both Mike Flynn and his son, who work with him in these business activities, many of the business activities.
And when it comes to truthfulness and this investigation, the New York Times and some others reporting that Jared Kushner, Mr. Trump's son-in-law and a special advisor to the president, got a letter from Charles Grassley and Dianne Feinstein, the two-ranking member, the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, complaining that Mr. Kushner has not been completely forthcoming with documents that they had requested, that particular committee. This is, I guess, I've sort of lost track of the number of investigations currently underway. I think it's around five with various committees and the special counsel. But what can we make of Mr. Kushner's apparent, inattentiveness to the request from that committee?
Well, we know that Chuck Grassley and Dianne Feinstein, the leaders of the Senate Judiciary Committee, have gotten crosswise on this investigation into Russia this year. But one point on which they agree is that Jared Kushner needs to turn over all the materials responsive to their request. So it was unusual enough that those two banded together this week to send a letter to Kushner's lawyer. Kushner's lawyer, Abby Lowell, says they are cooperating. They think they have been responsive, but they're going to take another look at all the documents. And of course, Tom, this is a theme, not just with Jared Kushner, who's been forced to revise on numerous occasions various government forms this year that detail his financial holdings and potential conflicts, but also numerous requests for documents. And when news reports come out suggesting he received other emails, demands for stuff he may not have turned over. This was a theme we heard, too, this week with regard to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, whose memory has evolved over time with respect to the contacts he had with Russians last year and what he knew about others involved in the Trump campaign. Jeff Sessions rather humorously defended himself this week by saying, listen, the Trump campaign was an exercise in chaos. We were on the road all the time. I hardly got any sleep. It was hard to remember a lot of these things. But Sessions, too, has had to revise his public accounts throughout the year. And it's not clear to me that he's done revising his public accounts of events last year.
You and everybody else. Yeah, there's a lot of dogs eating a lot of homework in that whole situation there. I want to ask you about one thing before we let you go. You wrote about Brett Talley. He's a young lawyer. He's in his mid-30s. He has never even tried a case. And he has been nominated by Donald Trump, who bragged during the campaign about how he would nominate great people, or how we would have great people in his administration. He's been nominated to be a federal judge in Alabama. This is a lifetime appointment. Here's Alabama in the news yet again. And it turns out that his wife is an attorney for who's working in the White House. Her name is Annie Donaldson, and she is the chief of staff to Donald F. McGahn, who is Mr. Trump's lawyer. What if people, you wrote a piece about the ABA, the American Bar Association, who had weighed in about this guy. What's the feeling on the Hill about this particular nomination?
So Brett Talley, who is a graduate of Harvard Law School, I should say, was rated unanimously not qualified by the American Bar Association. In the past 30 years, there have only been four such people. Two of them have come in the Trump administration this year alone. The White House defends Brett Talley as a fine lawyer and a good candidate for the bench. Democrats have a lot of questions about some of his blogging activities. Before he worked in the government, Brett Talley blogged after tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, that the right to bear arms was under siege. He blogged about a number of other controversial topics, some of which he did not disclose to the Senate Judiciary Committee in the course of his judicial nomination. And despite a lot of concern from Democrats expressed on the Hill, it's going to take a lot to stop him from getting a lifetime appointment on the federal bench, because Republicans simply have the votes in the Senate to confirm Brett Talley and a number of other picks by President Trump for federal judgeships. In fact, the Federalist Society convention is going on right now in Washington, D.C., where people in the Trump administration and outside are touting President Trump's judges as one of the most important legacies he will leave.
Carrie Johnson, she covers justice, law enforcement, and legal affairs for NPR. Carrie, thank you so much. Appreciate the time. Have a great weekend.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
When we come back after a quick break, we'll talk more about the national and local stories of the week with Baltimore Sun's Andy Green and longtime political columnist Barry Raskovar. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall on this Friday. By the way, coming up Monday on Midday, as we approach the holidays, we're going to focus on the nearly 3,000 people who are experiencing homelessness in Baltimore. Does the city do enough to help the homeless? And what more should and could be done? It's a conversation coming up Monday here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday News Wrap. And joining me in Studio A, Andy Green. He's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Andy, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
And Barry Raskovar. He's a longtime political columnist with the Baltimore Sun, then the Gazette newspaper. And today his columns appear on his blog, politicalmaryland.com, and in the Community Times. Barry, always a pleasure, sir.
Great to see you again.
If you would like to join our conversation about the news of the week, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, to find us on Twitter at Midday Tom Hall. Let's talk about the tax bill first, Andy Green. The House passed this bill. It now is up to the Senate, which appears to be scheduled to vote on something on their plan after Thanksgiving, and then they're going to have to reconcile these two things. Paul Ryan seemed to have fairly easy going of it when it came to moving that particular bill through the Senate.
That is the House. It's a different story in the Senate, and different story in the Senate. We have already had a couple of Republican senators either say flat out they will not vote for the bill in the current form or something very close to that. There are others whose votes are very uncertain, and they can only lose two votes among the Republicans and have this go through. And in the Senate, the fact that they are now tacking on to this a repeal of the individual mandate from the Affordable Care Act means that any slim hope that any Democrats, Heidi Heitkamp of South Dakota or something like that, might have signed on to this are pretty much gone now. That's not going to happen. Meanwhile, there are some pretty significant differences between the House bill and the Senate bill. Among them, of particular concern to Marylanders is the deductibility of state and local property taxes. Both versions of the bills whack the state and local income tax deduction, but the House version, thanks to pressure from Republicans from New Jersey, New York, and some other states, which have higher tax burdens, have managed to retain some deductibility for state and local property taxes. The Senate doesn't have that because they don't have the same political exigencies in the Republican Party there. So that's going to be a big sticking point. In order for the Obamacare portion of the Senate bill to fly, in even the Republican caucus, there's a lot of talk that they would need to tack on the Alexander Murray, the Lamar Alexander, Patty Murray bill to shore up the insurance exchanges. But that's basically a total non-starter in the House. So even though this rolled through the House pretty easily, relatively speaking, and even though they're talking about a vote very soon in the Senate, this is far from over.
So, Barry Raskovar, what does this do to the Republican brand if you've got congressmen and women now on record voting against things like deducting property taxes, again, you know, limiting the, how much you can deduct for your mortgage interest? You know, these are somewhat sacred, sacrosanct parts of the tax code, some of which have been in there for decades and generations.
Well, the Republican Party really is at a pivotal point in its history. Whether it's going to become the party of Donald Trump and Stephen Bannon and Roy Moore, I mean, you can go down the line here. But the Republican Party has already started to abandon its historic principles, such as free trade, which has been a bedrock policy of the Republicans since World War II. That's now gone. So, you know, a lot of the tax policies of the Republican Party of the past are giving way to, this new breed of conservative Republicans who, you know, you got to wonder exactly what they're thinking about, because you look at the most recent polls, for instance, on the tax proposal, and you see that people are 2-1 against this Republican plan. And it looks as though there are some ticking time bombs within the House bill and the Senate bill. And the question is, when do they explode? Because, for instance, the deductibility of state and local taxes. Well, when people begin to realize that this means double taxation on them for that income, they may be mad as heck and go to the polls and vote for against anybody who's got an R next to their name. So you know, this is a real difficult time for Republican leaders, because the party is changing, and we're not sure if it's even going to be recognizable in a few years from now.
And this tax bill is a point, I think, where the establishment is just trying to hang on by its fingernails to say, look, if there's one thing surely we can agree on between the new Republicans and the old Republicans, it's cutting taxes. But, you know, the way this bill has shaped up is interesting in that, you know, it abandons a lot of sort of the populist ideas that the Trump administration came in with the promise of anyway, and sinks a whole lot into corporate tax cuts. You know, the driving thing, particularly in the Senate bill, is cutting the corporate income tax rate from 35% down to 20%.
And that's in both bills.
Yeah, right. It's in both bills. But the interesting, in the Senate bill, they sunset a lot of the individual income tax provisions to after 2025. The corporate tax cuts, those are forever. So, you know, this is really what's driving the bus here, is cutting the corporate tax rate way lower than, you know, even Mitt Romney was only talking like 26% or so with assorted loophole closing, and they're going all the way down to 20. That's what's really driving the cost of this, and making it more difficult for them to provide that tax break for middle and working class people, while staying within the already fairly generous decision to add $1.5 trillion to the deficit over the next decade.
Let's take a phone call from Michael in Fells Point. Michael, welcome to Midday with Andy Green and Barry Raskovar.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask a question. I guess you just touched on the corporate tax rate, but maybe how is that going to affect the business economy, and what kind of typical economic output do you see from a corporate tax rate? And then also, how are individual rates going to be affected by the bill? And then I just wanted to make a quick comment about how I think as a progressive and as a millennial, I think we really need to move past the Nancy Pelosi's and Chuck Schumer's of the world. And I think the Democratic Party needs to start to become more representative of its base. And I think it's time for people to step aside, and it's time for people who are voting for Democrats to start representing Democrats and progressives in this country.
Okay, Michael, well, thanks for the call. A couple of different topics here. So, Barry Raskovar, there's two things about the corporate tax cut. Number one, the actual rate that many corporations pay isn't anywhere near 35%.
No, it's about 25, 26%, actually.
But the theory—
And in some industries, much lower.
Yeah, much lower. In some, in theory, if they're not spending money on taxes, they're going to spend money on R&D, and they're going to spend money hiring new people, and they're going to spend money giving raises to everybody who works for them. Has that ever worked before? Has that theory ever happened?
It hasn't worked as well as Donald Trump tells us it has worked. The other thing is that most economists agree that we are in the final stages of our growth spurt in this country right now, that we're overdue for a recession. And to cut taxes at this point might help sustain the growth a little longer, but it's not going to lead to 5% growth in this country. It's not going to, we're almost at full employment. So how this is going to spur the creation of millions of jobs is a debatable question. And it's going to spur inflation, which Janet Yellen, now the outgoing chair of the Federal Reserve, has been very concerned about. And this could really boomerang quite badly in its impact. But the impact is spread out, really, over a long period, so that you won't feel the full effects until after the next presidential election. Now, isn't that funny?
Yeah, what a coinky dinky.
Yeah. And then as far as the question goes about the personal, the individual income tax rates, that's really, really complicated.
Although the bottom rate, which is now 10%, has been raised to 12% is now 10%. So there are more people on the bottom of the scale who are going to pay more money.
Yes, there are some people kind of throughout the scale who are going to wind up paying more money. It all really depends a lot on your individual circumstances. So some of the thing in the House bill, they're collapsing down the number of brackets to 4 from the current 7. And it would be too difficult to explain off the top of the head exactly what income thresholds is kick in, but if you Google it, there are plenty of places you can find that. But the other things they're doing, they're eliminating personal exemptions from the tax code. They're doubling the standard deduction, so they're basically trying to steer more people into using the standard deduction instead of itemizing. They are limiting, as we said earlier, deductions for state and local income taxes and property taxes. They are putting limits on mortgage interest deduction for new home purchases. Other people would be grandfathered in. So they're eliminating the alternative minimum tax, if that matters to you. They're eliminating the estate tax, I would say, if that matters to you, but that probably matters to approximately 0 people who are listening to this. So it's incredibly complicated. If you were to sit down and think, what does this mean for me? I would say it would be nearly impossible to do.
It is difficult, Michael, to understand in any broad brush way, how it's going to affect, because it's going to be affected from people different ways.
In general terms, this is an exercise in the trickle-down theory of economics.
Yeah.
Because
we're back
there's
to David Stockman and Reagan.
Yeah. And it goes back to, the rich are going to benefit from this. Corporations are going to benefit permanently from this. Some people in the middle class may benefit, but a large number of people in the middle class and lower class will not benefit whatsoever. In fact, they'll be paying more taxes. And the gap between the very rich and the rest of us is going to widen dramatically.
And our grandchildren and great-grandchildren certainly aren't benefiting much because this blows a huge hole in the deficit. Deficit hawks are now very difficult to find in Washington, at least on the right side of the aisle, which is a really fascinating historical moment as well. But Andy Green, the donors expect a tax bill.
Yes,
they expected the repeal of the ACA and a tax bill. And maybe the Senate has come up with an ingenious way of giving them a twofer, because they're basically going to dismantle Obamacare by eliminating the pool of people purchasing insurance that the system will require.
Yes, and some Republicans have really been pretty explicit in saying that. There's a congressman a week or two ago who said, well, my my donors are saying, don't call me again unless you pass tax cuts. So that is definitely a big part of the equation. And also you can see that is part of how the bill is shaped the way it is, with so much of the cost of it going toward corporate tax cuts. And, you know, the one thing I will say to our caller from Fells Point, I can pretty much assure you that if you are extremely rich, this will be good for you.
Yeah, the thing is that again, the Republican Party is really having an internal civil war right now, and can't figure out who it is. This thing ignores the fact that we had an election a few weeks ago, and it was a virtual tidal wave of anger against Republicans in New Jersey, in Virginia, and in other places throughout the country.
And could augur quite difficult things for the Republicans in 2018,
right.
And which is just a year away.
So you wonder if they do get this bill passed with the elimination of the mandate for health care coverage, and 13 million people are affected and could lose their coverage, what in the world is going to happen to the Republican Party next November? And you got to wonder, what are they thinking in Washington, the so-called leaders of the Republican Party?
And central to that civil war in the Republican Party is Judge Roy Moore. We have a call about Judge Moore from Frank in Aberdeen. Frank, welcome to Midday with Andy Green and Barry Raskobar.
Good afternoon. First, a correction. The standard deduction did not double. It's only up 89%. They took it from $25,400 to $24,000.
Fair point, sir. Right. Thank you.
Point well taken.
The other thing is I've been going through, I've read 9 different Alabama newspapers about Moore, and they constantly defer to him. And first, I want to tell you, one actually extensively quoted a minister about how moral Moore is and how immoral Doug Jones is because of his positions. But the interesting thing was an article I read yesterday. The headline was schoolmate of accuser says Moore is creepy and icky. It could have said schoolmate of victim of alleged victim.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, creepy and itchy and scratchy. I mean, who knows what?
Well, but it is, I think, certainly true that the view of this from Alabama appears to be fairly different than it is in the rest of the country, particularly within the Alabama Republican Party. They're sticking with him. You know, there have been some particularly bizarre defenses of the guy. My favorite, of course, being that you know, there was a big age gap between Mary and Joseph as well. The idea of somehow trying to kick him off the ticket never gained any traction there. There's been some polling to suggest that the Democrat in that race may now be ahead, but that
Fox News has him up by 8 points. There was an internal poll that was released by the Republican Party of Alabama, which showed an even wider gap. That was sort of discounted, but this Fox News poll, people are taking a little bit more seriously, Barry Raskobar. I mean, and if there is a write-in candidate, if it's not Sessions, if it's not Luther Strange, maybe there's somebody else that decides to step up, would that not be very advantageous to Doug Jones, the Democratic candidate?
We don't know. A write-in candidate might take votes away from Doug Jones. The Alabama voters have a moral dilemma here. Do they put politics over morality? And that's really what it boils down to. And if indeed Roy Moore wins that election, what do the Republicans in the U.S. Senate do? Do they accept this person because he is tailor-made for the next Democratic election campaign? Roy Moore is going to become the poster child for the Republican Party.
And that's an interesting scenario because, you know, and we got to take a little break, but I do want to bring this up because if the Senate, if he's elected by the citizens of Alabama and the Senate chooses to expel him for activity and assaults that he committed before he was in the Senate, what does that mean for Al Franken? Mm-hmm. Who also committed and admitted to and apologized for similar behavior with an adult, not with a child.
They're not going to expel him. They can't. the Senate.
So the notion that they're just overriding the will of the people of Alabama is
well, no, they could expel him for actions he took as a senator, but for prior actions, you know, that's way beyond what the Senate would mm-hmm. do or anybody would do.
So, Andy, do you think that Al Franken is banking on that himself?
Well, I think, I mean, Al Franken has invited an ethics probe.
Yeah, he's calling
activity.
For a probe of himself.
So one suspects that this could lead to some sort of reprimand of some kind. But, you know, again, let's wait and see whether anything more comes out. You know, what we know about it so far, you know, we don't know of anything more than this one incident with him. You know, we'll see whether this represents some kind of pattern of behavior or not. I don't know. But, you know, I suspect that we have not heard the end of this by any means.
Got to take a little bit break. Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Barry Raskovar is a longtime political columnist with the Sun, the Gazette newspapers, and now at politicalmaryland.com in the Community Times. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap when we come back from a break. We're going to concentrate on some of the big local stories this week. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org to find us on Twitter. We're at Midday Tom Hall. Before we take a break, this news from the world of philanthropy. Anthony Deering, a former executive with the Rouse Company, passed away last night at his home here in Baltimore. Tony and his wife, Lynn, have been mainstays of the arts and culture scene for many years. Center Stage, the Friends School of Baltimore, the Baltimore Museum of Art, Johns Hopkins Medicine, they're just a few of the many institutions that the Deering family have supported with large gifts over a long period of time. So our hearts go out to the Deering family. Tony Deering was 72 years old. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. My guests here in Studio A, Andy Green. He's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Barry Raskovar, longtime political columnist. And Dominique Maria Bonessi joins us. She's WYPR's City Hall reporter. Dominique, good to see you.
Thank you, Tom.
So you have just gotten back from the announcement of the verdict in the trial board hearing of Lieutenant Brian Rice. What happened?
Yes, so Lieutenant Brian Rice was found not guilty on all charges. There were 10 charges, administrative charges against him in his trial board, and the panel had their say and said that he was not guilty. This is the second trial board that has dropped, not dropped, but just said not guilty on all charges. The first one, of course, was Officer Caesar Goodson Jr., who was the wagon driver during the Freddie Gray incident in April of 2015, whose charges had 21 charges against him, and all those were dropped also.
So fewer charges. Were there any charges that were similar to the charges leveled against Officer Goodson?
Right. So the policy of neglect and conduct is like a general order C2 with the Baltimore City Police Department, and that essentially is just saying that they neglected a specific duty at the time. So there was that. And then also policy 1114, and that we know now from the criminal trials and from these trial boards that was never communicated to the Baltimore police officers. On April 9th, it was broadcasted. It was sent out via email. None of the officers saw that in their email, including Brian Rice, including Officer Caesar Goodson. And then we had them in the court actually using K-14, which is the previous policy to 1114, in using that as what the policy they were following at the time of the incident.
Sergeant Alicia White is the next person on deck to undergo a trial board hearing. That's to take place sometime after Thanksgiving. You know, here's two attempts to discipline officers, perhaps with discipline as severe as, you know, removing them from the police force. What does this tell us about what Officer White can expect?
Right. So Michael Davey, Rice's lawyer today, was saying that the evidence is what it is. All these charges stem from the same incident. If you're not, he's asking the prosecution that if you're finding that these charges are going not guilty on all of these officers, then maybe you should reconsider Alicia White's trial even. So that brings into question whether or not maybe the department will change their mind and just say, we're going to not have her trial. But it is expected to happen in early December.
And Andy Green, this happens in the context of a very sad event, which occurred Wednesday afternoon. Officer Sean Souter,
detective,
43 years old, father of five children. He was the 309th person murdered in our city since the 1st of January. He was in Harlan Park looking into a crime that had committed
a murder
from last year. Mm-hmm. Shot, and there's now a $169,000 reward being offered
up to 190 now.
$190, okay, it's gone up in the last half hour.
Yes.
The governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, is thrown in another $100,000, and of course, as T.J. Smith from the Baltimore Police said today, it shouldn't cost 69 cents to have somebody give us information about this murder.
I mean, this is an incredibly sad story, and for all of the fraught relations that people in Baltimore have had with the police department over the years, something like this, I think, really does sober people up and remind you of the dangers that Baltimore police officers face doing their jobs every day. You know, this is an officer that nobody has a bad word to say about this guy, that, you know, he was just a solid police officer, great demeanor, you know, easygoing guy that, had great future potential, you know, as you said, father of five kids. And
not the kind of person who one would assume would be the focus of things involved in the consent decree, for example. This is not a person has made any intimation that he's acted unconstitutionally against people.
And, doing his job, he was out investigating a murder with another officer. They saw someone suspicious and split up to try to find that person. He was Detective Souter was shot in the head and taken to shock trauma. Died about a day later. There's a massive manhunt going on in West Baltimore right now. Intense police presence. They've closed off blocks there. And you've certainly seen people from across the region really pulling together in this case. You know, as you mentioned, Governor Hogan added $100,000 to the reward. The $20,000 that you had not heard of comes from the Anne Arundel Police Department. Mm-hmm. People are, I think, really kind of taking this case to heart. The interesting thing with what T.J. Smith says, that it shouldn't take 69 cents for someone to come forward with this, that's true. However, it does lead you to think about what it is that prevents people from coming forward to talk about crimes in the city all the time. And that's often, I think, a fear of being subject of retribution. So, a reward of this size, maybe it's enough for somebody to say, I will start over again in some other city and I will tell what I know. I mean, that's, I think, what we can hope at this point.
And Barry Raskovar, Rod Rosenstein, formerly here in Maryland as a federal prosecutor, now the assistant attorney general, was in Chicago, last night, and he referenced the death of Detective Souter. And he said, yesterday afternoon in Baltimore, a homicide detective who worked closely with my office was shot in the head and passed away. So today we are praying for his family and the Baltimore Police Department, but prayer is not enough, Rosenstein said. He said the Baltimore City mayor admits that crime is, quote, out of control. That's, in fact, something that Mayor Pugh said last week. So Rosenstein went on to say in this speech that if that is true, people should be held accountable. Crime is not like the weather, he said. He said, if crime is out of control, it is because people failed to control it. In Baltimore, local authorities lost confidence in their ability to manage public safety, which is the most important function of government. He is laying this at the feet of Kevin Davis, Catherine Pugh, Jack Young, Marilyn Mosby.
Well, it's interesting because most of the people you mentioned haven't been on duty that long. This thing didn't start when Catherine Pugh was elected. It didn't start when Marilyn Mosby was elected. And it certainly didn't start when Kevin Davis took over running the police department. This is deep-seated. This has to do with the historic segregation of housing in Baltimore City, and just the treatment of African Americans in Baltimore City by people in power over the decades. How you turn it around is the question. And one of the things that I wonder is exactly what citizens of Baltimore desire from their police officers. Because right now, a police officer in Baltimore City doesn't have a clue whether he should go after the bad guy or just let him run away. Because you saw what happened with the Freddie Gray episode, in which there was a rush to indictment, which then leads to these trial boards where you're seeing that there are deep-seated problems within mm-hmm. the police department that have to be addressed first.
And Dominique Maria Benessi, I mean, are the folks that you're talking to at the police department and the state's attorney's office and at City Hall, what are they saying? This theory that, you know, the police have been taking a knee since 2015 when the Freddie Gray incident happened has led to this huge spike in crime. We're on track to have a record number of murders, which we haven't had since in 20 years, 25 years.
I think you also have to look at the low attrition rate of the police department itself. I mean, they're down at any day at least 500 officers that they should have. But I also think that, Mayor Pugh has been looking at this head on since the beginning of her administration. She's been dealing with this. It's not new. It didn't just all of a sudden spike. It's been slowly building up to this, 309 homicides that we've had. And of course, we need to look at this and say, well, we need to be proactive, but at the same time, we need to look at what the solutions are and how we're going to come out of this.
You know, Andy Green, in your newspaper, a physician at Hopkins Community Physicians here in Remington, right near mm-hmm. where we sit as we speak, Dr. Cecina Kobede, said we can't jail our way out of the problem of youth crime. There's
yes.
been an uptick.
I got in a little argument with Chief Davis about that earlier this week.
Because we've got 13, 14, 15-year-olds yeah. committing crimes in the Inner Harbor, in Homeland, in Federal Hill, in yeah. Fells Point, in neighborhoods that aren't used to having the kind of crime that, frankly, the citizens of Harlem Park and Sandown Winchester have been living with for generations.
Yes. I mean, we have, I think, periodically seen spikes in youth violence like this that causes real alarm. There was one a few years ago after some incidents at the Inner Harbor. The question is, how do you handle these kids? Chief Davis said the problem here is that too many of these juveniles who start out in charged in the adult court system get waved down to juvenile court, and they're not being punished or experiencing consequences because of that. And we in the editorial page had argued that, actually we know what happens when you deal with kids in the adult court system. They go to adult prisons and they spend 10 years, 20 years having their moral development by convicts.
Right, but Chief Davis is making the same argument about the teenagers that he makes about the kids in their 20s and early 30s. Mm-hmm. You're saying that we're arresting them multiple times and then the courts are letting them back out on the street.
Be curious to see whose fault it is next.
But I think it raises the question, do we have alternative programs in place?
Yeah.
That would be effective as an alternative. Mm-hmm. And I think the answer is no, we do not. And the other thing that this raises is, where's the governor? The governor right now is saying the right things, but there's no financial commitment by the state to help Baltimore City in this time of crime crisis.
And if Jack Young has his way, the Associated Black Charities will be dispensing about $12 million for youth programs. We'll see if that's a step in the right direction. And the mayor has tried to bring in the different departments of the city to work at this holistically. And I appreciate your holistic approach to all of our news this week. Thanks to everybody. Appreciate you guys coming by.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
Barry Raskovar is a longtime political columnist. He's blogging at politicalmaryland.com. Andy Green's the editorial page editor at the Baltimore Sun. And Dominique Maria Bonessi is a WIPR's City Hall reporter. That'll do it for us today. We want to thank Marie-Louise Bistro for lunch today. They're located on Charles Street in Mount Vernon. They specialize in a blend of French, Italian, and Mediterranean cuisines. They're open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, or dinner with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Menu and reservations at Marie-Louise Bistro Catering. Midday.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill produced the program. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. We are grateful for production assistance from Sienna Greaves and our digital producer, Jamila Krempel. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. I look forward to being with you next week. Have a great weekend.